This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
We're back now with another segment of I Was There When. This is where we speak to people who were on the scene during a big moment in New Zealand's history. And yesterday, of course, marked the 40th anniversary of the Trades Hall bombing in Wellington. One of the many people who were on the scene in the immediate aftermath of that explosion was the Evening Post's industrial relations reporter Tim Donohue. And Tim joins me now. Kia ora to you.
Good evening, Emil.
It's lovely having you here, Tim. Thank you very much for joining us. Why don't we start by getting you to take us back to that moment that you arrived outside the Trades Hall building. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday, Emil. On the late afternoon of the bombing, I was at work on the first floor of the Old Dominion building on Willis Street, overlooking Mercer Street. In the desk in front of me was a fellow by the name of Paul Moran, who for many years looked after the town council for the Dominion. And Paul was a great guy. Sadly, he died late last year. But tucked away behind Paul and I were two pros on the police desk in those days. And one of them was David Lomas of TV fame these days, and the other was Susan Arthur. And they both plied their trade as crack police reporters. And as part of their job, they monitored police radios. And about 5:20 on the afternoon of March 27, 1984, news came over the police radio that there had been an incident at Trades Hall. All eyes in the newsroom just happened to turn upon me at that time, as I was the industrial reporter. And it was a case of on your bike, down you go to the bomb site, son, via Willis and Marion Streets down to Vivian Street. I was quite fit in those days, and I was on the scene by about 5:45 p.m. And when I got there, the radio and TV guys, they were also starting to arrive. And police were on the scene immediately after the bombing, as there was a police station directly across Vivian Street on Niggs Avenue. And we in the media pack, we were corralled over the road on the intersection of Niggs Avenue and Vivian Street. It seemed to me, I recall, that everyone on the scene was in a deep state of shock. I was fortunate in that I knew a number of the major players who'd been in the building when the bomb went off. And my major job for the paper that night would be to find out if anyone had been injured or killed in the blast and who they were.
Was it clear, Tim, was it clear when you arrived what had happened, or was there a period of like, my God, what has actually gone on here?
I think, Emil, that basically people were stunned.
Yeah.
We were over the road on Vivian Street looking at a front door which had obviously been severely damaged. And there was glass windows that had been destroyed by the bomb. And these were like situations which I knew from previous experience that police would, but understandably, normally they wouldn't be confirming for us, particularly in the case of anyone who had died, until the following day, what the details of those people were. But so for about an hour, I just remained outside the hall, as I said, in a state of numbness, just approaching people I knew who, I was fortunate that I knew them, they were coming out of the building. And I stayed there for about an hour, and by the time I left to head back to our Willis Street office, the name of caretaker Ernie Abbott, for all the wrong reasons, was front of mind as being the victim of the bombing.
Had you ever come across Ernie in your journalistic career or anything like that?
Yeah, I had actually. I had been on the job as industrial reporter in those days for about 15 months. And I would go down to Trades Hall two or three times a week. And it would always be a case of, hello, how's it going? There was no, I can't say that I knew the man intimately. And, but, you know, I just found him to be a very affable man. And, yeah, I didn't know, but I knew him well enough to talk to him, and he was always very polite in terms of my cursory dealings with him. But I went back that night to, I was given a job of writing a background piece on Ernie for the following day's paper, and if possible, just to come up with a photo. And it wasn't an easy one because no one on the record in authority was confirming that it was Ernie who had been killed in the blast. So, as you know, we journalists, like, we hit the phones, and I confirmed from a number of sources that Ernie Abbott, the cleaner, and the vice president of Wellington Straits Council, boss Pat Kelly's Caretakers and Cleaners Union, had indeed been the man who died in that blast. A contact was also able to provide a photo of Ernie, which I was able to obtain that night. And that's incidentally the same photo which has been used to identify him in most of the media coverage over the past 40 years. On the staff of those days, Jeff Bayliss was our relatively new editor, and he prevailed over a mid-evening news conference when the decision was made to run the pick and name this likable, humble cleaner as the unfortunate victim of the blast. And Bayliss came from a top-level background of journalism in England, and he was a total pro when it came to these situations. And as you can imagine, as you would know better than I, there's no prizes for getting these calls wrong in journalism. And Jeff, he had a gentle way of grilling his minions accordingly. I think, by way of background, the bombing, like, it occurred at a time when Robert Muldoon was the National Party Prime Minister. And those years, they were among the most tumultuous industrial relations years in New Zealand's history. And there was a national government wage freeze on in place at the time, and Muldoon was an advocate of voluntary unionism. Amidst all this, I did feel a bit sorry for Ernie and his family because he was portrayed as something of a martyr for the trade union movement. I have a recollection of him on the day of his funeral of being ferried through the streets of Wellington with a famous line from Kipling's Song of the Dead attached to the chariot which bore his body. And there's a line from that Kipling poem: "If blood be the price of your cursed wealth, for God we have bought it fair." Stein read. The funeral was held in the old Wellington Town Hall, and it was an occasion of great sorrow for members of the trade union movement. They shared stories about how Ernie had served on the HMNZS Lachlan, a river-class frigate, from 1949 to 1953. This ship was a survey and Antarctic supply vessel for some years. And details of the police investigation into the bombing gradually leaked out over the years, including one suggestion that this intricate, complicated bomb had been wrapped in an old Evening Post newspaper. Have you ever heard of a guy called John Parker, Emil?
No, not off the top of my head.
John was the very capable, long-serving industrial reporter on the Evening Post in those days, and he'd been the industrial reporter for many years. And as John's counterpart on the Dominion, I discovered very early on that there were few more perilous occupations in life in those days than that of an industrial reporter. And John was a very industrious industrial reporter in a difficult job. As you can imagine, the job involved trying to stay on side with the trade union movement.
Of course, yeah.
Which by its very nature was often openly very hostile towards members of the capitalist Tory press. Things came to a head between the Federation of Labour President Jim Knox and John Parker in 1982, I think, when Knox proclaimed he would no longer talk to Parker or any other reporter from the Evening Post. But this didn't stop John Parker and Sue Carty, Sue was a future editor of the paper, that roll up and cover the annual May FOL conferences in the Wellington Town Hall. And I used to look at John in wonderment at times, and clearly it helped him in his dealings with these hard-line trade unionists, that John himself was a chain smoker, and he was an ex-2NZDF serviceman during World War II. Jim Knox, who headed up the Federation of Labour in those days, he was an affable, gregarious, loquacious man. He went out of his way to accuse Parker of trying to discredit and split the trade union movement. It concerned him that Parker was very closely allied to the right-wing faction of the union movement, headed up by the Electrical Workers Union, Tony Neary. And back in the trades hall, there were some real hardliners, no absolute characters. And I used to see them on a weekly basis, but people like Con Devitt from the Boilermakers Union, who was at the peak of his powers in those days.
It's a fascinating wider story with some fascinating characters involved with it, of course. And as it was talked about pretty much everywhere yesterday, it's been 40 years since then. Many of those around from that time are no longer with us. Do you think this case will ever be solved, Tim, or is it just one of those things that will remain a mystery?
I do feel for people like Ted Lyons, who he conducted that initial investigation for many years, and clearly the case, it was a hospital pass that was ended up in Ted's very capable hands. I think sadly he never got the justice he deserves, but this is no reflection on the exhaustive police investigation that Ted Lyons, he conducted in those early days of the investigation. That narrow band of suspects, as every year goes by, five is probably down to two or one at the moment. Mm. And somehow I think no amount of money is going to get whoever may have perpetrated this despicable act out of the woodwork.
Tim Donohue, it's a fascinating story, and I'm sorry that you had to go down and cover it, but I suppose that's what journalists do at times like this. And thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about that, and indeed about Ernie as well. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Emil. Cheers. Good night.
It's Tim Donohue, who was the Evening Post's industrial relations reporter when the Trades Hall bombing happened back in 1984.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.